Rewind when capacitors blow select Frank. That's bad even by my standards. It's This Week in Retro.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
I'm not addicted. I could stop whenever I want.
Sexy time.
And please don't go.
All this and more coming up on today's show.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Hello, we have a guest. We have Dave, as usual. And we have the wonderful Frank from Retro Rewind. Thank you for joining us, Frank.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's great to have you here. And we will, of course, be talking lots about Retro Rewind later in the show. And Frank is probably, I think, the most experienced podcaster we've ever had on the show. You've got history, haven't you, Frank?
Yeah, just a little bit of a history, yeah.
Yeah.
In podcasting and broadcast TV.
Can you share any of that, or is that something you don't like to remember these days?
I don't know if it's about not wanting to share as much as just don't remember half of it.
Oh, okay. It was
almost 20 plus years ago on a small cable station here in North America called Tech TV with this small journalist named Leo Laporte.
Just a nobody, that Leo Laporte.
Yeah.
Never heard of him. So anyone who's familiar with the This Week In shows, excluding us, will be very familiar with Leo Laporte. He's a great presenter. He's been doing it for such a long time, and he works to a very high standard. At least from my side, you saw behind the scenes.
Yeah, he was. He's very influential in the community, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So, Frank, what have you been up to this week? Have you been up to anything retro?
I was hoping to make it to the shop this morning, but for your listeners, it's shortly after 7 a.m. here in Toronto. So I decided to just do it in my home workshop more than anything. Repairing machines, mostly. That's pretty much seems to be the only thing we've been doing the past couple of months.
Repairing me. And if that's your home workshop that we can see there, goodness knows how wonderful the work one looks, because I can see PVMs, I can see things mounted on the wall. What have we got there? Is that a 128, a Commodore 128 on the wall there?
Yeah, so I mean, we've got I've got every machine, at least a single copy of every machine I need to work on. And okay. Pretty much all these machines are used for testing purposes or development purposes. It's easier to just grab it down off the shelf and figure out, let's see how this actually works.
So that's functional. That's not just aesthetic. That's not just nice to have on the wall. Fantastic. Good. Well, this week, I've secured something for the museum that I don't know if you'll have heard of this. I'm sure you'll have heard of this, but it's pretty rare. It's called the Arcadia system. It's an Amiga-based arcade, 10 slots. It's actually in Canada, Frank. That's where I've managed to buy it from. So now I have to deal with, how do you ship something that's 30 kilograms from Canada over to the UK? If you've got any tips, please let me know. And it's a system that actually originated in the UK. Kim Justice put out a fantastic video just last week about Mastertronic, and this featured in it because it was a project between Arcadia and Mastertronic, a UK-based software publisher. And for that reason, in the UK, this system was put in Electrocoin, the company Electrocoin cabinets, which we can still get get hold of quite freely in the UK. So I'm hoping to reunite this system with an original cabinet and have perhaps the worst possible Amiga experience for people to try in the cave. But it's all part of computer history, so I'm really excited about that. Yeah, Dave?
It does fit in with your PlayChoice and your Megatech, though. I mean, the three of those together kind of do fit in.
Yeah, I've removed Galaxian from the cave now. That's gone down to the arcade. So any arcades I have in the cave are just, you know, those home systems, but multi-system arcades.
Yeah,
so it's a nice way to experience them. Yeah. Dave, what have you been up to? Any pinball featured this week?
No, absolutely no movement on pinball, which is fine because I've got loads of other things on the go. I have, however, been watching the Fallout TV show. Now, we talked about 3-4 months ago, we talked about how there's been very few things moved from games to film or TV that have been actually good. Well, they've finally done it. Fallout TV show is great. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Quite a few kind of forced in kind of callbacks to the games for people who played them. But I think if you haven't played the games, you'll still enjoy it. So I've been binging that. I will watch more of it today if I can possibly get away with it. But yeah, I'm surprised that they've finally managed to take something from the gaming world and put it onto the big screen and not make it rubbish. And I was really expecting this to be a bit naff, and it wasn't.
Well, The Witcher.
You weren't a big fan of Witcher?
Yeah, I was just about to say that for
you. Yeah, it was okay. I'm not a big fan of it. I don't actually like the games that much, to be honest, the Witcher games. That's maybe why. But yeah, certainly we were talking about movies, and there's just no great movies, if you know what I mean.
My wife is not a gamer, but she's a big Witcher fan, but I'm convinced that's because of Henry Cavill and not because of the story at all.
I would have to agree. That's the same in my house too.
Should we get into our first story?
Yeah. I'll start with this with something controversial. Oh. I think most of you are addicts, at least by 1983 standards. But don't worry, I'll dial right back on that as we talk. So sometimes the BBC, that's the British Broadcasting Corporation, releases clips from their archives, and that's just what they did this week.
Oh, this is a story. I thought you were going to go into a Pixel Addict commercial at this point, Dave.
No, Neil, no.
Oh, it would have been seamless. You missed the chance. Sorry, carry on.
Crompy has posted to the subreddit a clip about Chris Carter. It starts by showing him playing Mr. Do in a pub on an arcade machine. But the whole tone of the thing is treating, at least initially, is treating him like he's got an uncontrollable addiction that's ruining his life. He talks about how he doesn't like the smoke and the noise in the pub, but he goes there because he wants to play the arcade games. And he talks about how you'll beat an arcade game over the space of a few days. But I'm guessing he's putting an awful lot of 10p's in. And then we go to his home where he spent thousands on micros, and he spends around 40 hours a week on them. And the BBC present this as if, what a crippling addiction this is. He says the revolution that brought computers into his home didn't change his social life, it destroyed it. And he's then bluntly accused of having a problem being addicted.
He is. 40 hours a week. It's a lot, but I'm going to say a lot more is spent these days by people on their smartphones. Dave's holding his smartphone up there. There's an option on your phone, isn't there, to see how many hours you've spent on and yeah. I refuse yeah. to look. I yeah. refuse
it's
to
terrifying.
Look.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. yeah.
But people listening to this probably spend 20, 40 hours a week on some kind of thing like that. It's then on to Graham Hawker, who's a man that looks to be around our age now, so this was going back 40 years ago, playing text adventures, and finally on to Phyllis Arundale in her sweet shop. She bought a computer to help with the accounts, and with the time it saved her on her account, she's written her own program, and she's now on to building PCBs. And I would say building PCBs in the 80s is not the same as building PCBs now. It's a lot more difficult.
Not going into the sponsor shot slot there, Dave.
No, it would
have been seamless again.
No. Not turning us into cheap TV. But this is this again is 1983. Things were very different in 1983 for home computer use. The ZX80 and ZX81 and then the ZX Spectrum were the ones that were for the masses and not the classes. There was micros you could have before then, but they didn't really take on the same way that really anyone who wanted one could go and get one with the Spectrum range. And they were just taking hold. So this is very early in Britain's relationship with home computers. And the tone of the piece comes across as very conservative, pearl clutching way.
You can't be a Scottish piracy man and not be able to say the word pearl.
Purple burglar alarm. It's clear that the people featured are thoroughly enjoying an enriching hobby, but it's not clear to the BBC. Now, as for myself, I did get horribly and harmfully addicted to things on computers, horribly so with MUDs and MMOs. So, Frank, what about you? Are you obsessed? You must be. And when did it start for you?
Obsessed, I think, is an understatement, to be perfectly honest with you. Probably around the age of 7 when I got my first micro. It was a Color Computer 2. I'm sure
it was the same thing for you guys. You kind of, you were influenced by your circle of friends, especially at school. And I was the lone kid with the Coco while everyone had Commodore 64s. So that didn't take long for me to convince my parents to sell the Coco to get a Commodore 64. Frankly, I haven't looked back.
Yeah. Do you regret it?
That's a loaded question. You got about 3 hours?
Short answer, no, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I guess starting a business kind of helped to mask the addiction. It's no longer called an addiction. Now it's called a business. But at the end of the day, it's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, a light bulb's just gone off above my head. Frank, what have you done?
You've got one of those neon, like, marquees over your head, not just a light bulb.
It says, I've got a problem, and I've masked it as under the heading museum. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Neil, what do you think? Are you an addict?
Am I an addict? Yeah. Yeah, I am, unashamedly so. On this piece in particular, it's all very new technology, bad. Look at this poor man who doesn't like to drink and smoke in the pub like the rest of them. He's addicted to computers. Isn't that terrible? And let's not forget, this is 1983, and the BBC's contribution to the computer literacy project is well underway at this point. So on the other hand, the BBC were embracing all of this. It was just clearly a different department. It's also funny that in a discussion about addiction, Chris Carter's pumping money into Mr. Do, and there's a chap next to him on a fruit machine pumping money, gambling into that. That isn't even mentioned. So, you know, there's a slightly, I'm not saying the guy on the fruity was an addict, but, you know, I would say that's a bigger problem than Mr. Do. And then when we see Graham, he's playing a very early Sierra Online game, and he's got an Apple II, which was slightly more unusual here in the UK. He's playing The Wizard and the Princess, also known as Adventure in Serenia. And for some reason, Graham is playing it standing up, which I assume is at the request of the camera operator, but it all looks very awkward. And he's got wonderful wallpaper behind him as well. And then Phyllis, I really loved Phyllis because she's talking about making her own peripherals. She pulls out of her box potentiometers and capacitors, and she's talking about them, and she's talking about making PCBs. And after this lovely chat, she's met with the question, are you a computer addict? And she's displaying no signs of addiction, really. She's just enjoying it in a very healthy way. So, yeah, they are gunning for that addict headline. But all that being said,
we should get a t-shirt made with that. Right? That
whole, yeah. Are you an addict?
Oh, I'm an addict, without question.
But with, you know, all that being said, the BBC was on to something. It was identifying the potential addictive nature of computer games. Well, computers, not just computer games, the computer itself, wanting to learn how it works, how to program and control it. You know, a lot of us with an addictive nature around computers just want to fully understand how to control this thing. How does it work inside out? You know, the addictiveness of that. And I think they've identified something important there. But I dread to think how this same piece would have been presented in 2024, you know, with the sensationalist nature of things today. This was sensationalist, I think, for 83, but it was still quite calm and reasoned compared to today's reporting. So I suspect it would have come across quite differently if it was made today.
I think they could find people to show real harmful addiction much easier today than they could in 1983. I mean, there's people who, in the mobile gaming world, there's people called whales who are what these microtransaction games are gunning for, and these are people who will have spent thousands. It's an addiction. It's a dopamine thing from spending money on it. There's you see parents whose kids have spent fortunes on mobile phones.
Frank, if you had to pick something that you've been the most addicted to with computers, whether it's a game or something else, have you ever, can you think of something that you've put a ludicrous number of hours into? MMO,
not something I'd admit publicly, but probably gaming. I'm a big role-playing game fan, I spent like an absurd amount of time and money, unfortunately, on MMORPGs, EverQuest. EverQuest, spent a lot
EverQuest.
Of time.
EverQuest.
That was even before Ultima Online. EverQuest was one of the
it was one of the first ones.
Yeah.
And then I had kids, and that all changed. I went cold turkey quickly.
What could you spend your money on in EverQuest? Was it just to fast track the stats, or were you buying?
No, you couldn't spend. There was no money. It was primarily your membership fees, your monthly membership fees, and that was it. Okay. I think there was later expansion packs that allowed it, but that was kind of after my addiction was over.
They hadn't got truly cynical with it at that point.
Yeah, I remember paying a monthly fee. How have we gotten to Ultima? I remember paying a monthly fee for Ultima and not thinking anything of it. I thought £10 a month or whatever it was value for money.
It is. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on.
So
that was my addiction. That's Frank's addiction. But
call my therapist now.
I think they could find addicts now in people playing League of Legends, all sorts of stuff. There's loads of people who are properly, fully addicted now, and these three people seem to have an enjoyment of a hobby. I do try to manage things better these days. I won't play MMOs now. I know it's bad for me, and I don't have the time to do it properly, so I won't do it. But I do get laser focused in whatever game I'm playing, and it's all I want to do. But I don't think I'd call it overall a harmful addiction. This is what I've enjoyed most in my life. If you look at my life, the joy I've had from playing games and meddling with computers, it's not a harmful addiction. I'm not giving
it's
up.
It's entertainment at the end of the day,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. We are sponsored this week by PCBWay.com. Who are PCBWay, Neil?
They are the greatest ever PCB manufacturing service to exist on Earth ever. And they've got a competition, Dave, a KiCad open source design contest. This is a contest, and you need to have your submissions in by the 2nd of June. So there's plenty of time to get them in. And they're asking you for, they're giving you an opportunity to showcase your creative and technical skills, inviting you to use that open source circuit board PCB designing package, KiCad. And share with everyone else. So they really are encouraging open source software, but also open source design on PCBWay so that people can share and use them to manufacture these PCBs.
So that fits in with their library of shared projects then. I'm imagining that the idea behind this, it adds to that library, allows you to pick out more there. There's loads of it.
It does. And somebody pointed out to me this week that there is in the shared projects a PS2 mouse to Sharp X68000 adapter. And I'm off to order them because I was trying to demonstrate Lemmings last week on the 68000 and I don't have a mouse for it. So that's the next thing I'm going to order from PCBWay.
Thank you for sponsoring us.
Thank you, PCBWay.com. It's sexy time, guys, because British high street retailer CEX is now offering a repair service for retro consoles on a no-fix, no-fee basis. Now, anyone who's walked into a CEX will immediately ask, how the hell are they going to do that? Because their stores don't exactly look like a repair lab. If anything, they look slightly like a failing DVD rental store. And that's because, it absolutely isn't. They are farming this out to another company called Tech Center. I've not heard of Tech Center before, but maybe some of our listeners have. Systems supported include Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sega consoles. I can see such things as the Master System and the NES supported on this website, as well as rarer systems such as the Sega Multimega, the little portable CD-based Sega CD. Handhelds are there, like the Atari Lynx, and they promise a 7-day turnaround, and oddly, absolutely everything is priced at $39.99. I tried clicking on all the consoles. Everything kept coming up as $39.99, including tax. Now, I would surely guess that price suggests diagnosis, perhaps, and then I would expect a phone call with an upsell for repair once my kit is in their hands. I've not tried it, so I can't say for sure. Dave?
$50, if anyone's wondering. $50 American dollars.
That's
what $39.99 is.
Plus the cost of your air ticket if you're going to fly over here with your kit and ask them to repair it. I know a man who can do that for you, but we'll come on to that. Micros are not supported by this service, and apparently a 2-year warranty comes with all their repair work. Now, I've had a hunt around. I can't find anyone yet sharing a review or their experience with this service, so I can't vouch for the quality of it in any way. But as there is a CEX near to the cave, I am sorely tempted to take something just to see how the whole experience pans out. Maybe
40 volts through it first.
But I've got plenty of broken stuff, maybe a Game Gear perhaps or something like that. So
I should show up with an arcade cabinet.
Yeah. Or I was thinking maybe put a Famiclone in a Mega Drive or something and really just mess with them and see what they come back with. So I might test that and I might report back on my experience. But it all sounds very easy, and a repair service is something that we've toyed with at the Retro Collective in a corner of the mill. But so far, we've kind of put that on hold, and we're sticking to internal repairs only for the museum because we've seen how much work it is just to repair our own kit, and we don't want to open up to the public and do a bad job. That's the risk. You know, you've got to be prepared to do that. So, as I mentioned, one man who knows all too well the challenges of running such a service, and that service is tried and tested and spoken of glowingly by many people who send their kit into repair. It's Frank, of course, the owner of RetroRewind.ca, and he's not scared of micros. They don't scare you, do they, Frank? What do you think about repairs being offered, retro repairs being offered by a high street chain? Does that ring any alarms?
It does. We had something similar here with a company about 5 years back. Their gimmick was to actually replace the internals of the unit with a much more modern solution. And I'm wondering if that's the way CEX is kind of thinking of doing their thing. Because as we all know, spare parts for some of these machines are near impossible to find. And when you do find them, they're crazy expensive. Just go look up the prices of an amber chip for an Amiga 3000. At I think the last they were going for was like $575 American, which is insanity. So I'm not sure what their plan is with this regard, but I know that a company here that did it for a few years, that's exactly what they were doing. They were replacing the internals with modern components. As you said, repair work, diagnostic work takes a lot of time. And you have to be a sucker for punishment, trust me, to be willing to take on anything like this. So good luck to them. I hope that they don't end up doing what the company local here did, because manufacturers came after him. They were sued. It got pretty ugly. But I think CEX is probably big enough to know better. At least their lawyers should know better.
Were they taking just the guts out and sticking a pie in it? That kind of thing?
They were essentially like single board FPGA systems. And essentially cores were stolen. That was ends up being the, one of the reasons they got sued, is a lot of the developers that were releasing cores, they were recompiling them for whatever FPGA they happened to be using on that board. So, all under the guise of repair work.
Yeah. Which is
not, no, it's not. Now we have customers that are purists, right? It doesn't matter. Like, I had a guy with an Amiga 2000, his childhood 2000, and the, corrosion, had gotten so bad into the pins of the 68,000 that he actually wanted me to repair the actual original 68,000 that was in there when I had a drawer full of them. I should have just done. I said, yeah, here, I spent 3 hours repairing it, put a different one in for him, but that's
you're
honest.
More honest.
To each his own. So we actually repaired the actual dip chip itself, the 68,000 chip, because that's what he wanted. It had three legs and we had to kind of epoxy and reset them. So, from a purist standpoint, I'd rather have my machine worked on and brought back in its original condition, but I know other people just want it working at times. So more power to them if it works for them.
Mm. Banjo Guy Ollie's just put out a video on him repairing Amiga chips that were really, really badly damaged, and he's dremeling the top of the chip off to expose contacts there so he can attach new legs to it. So they're apparently quite resilient and they can be repaired. So it can be done, but there's absolutely, in fact, I said this to Ollie, there's absolutely no way that was an economical repair in terms of time spent. And £40 or $50 American is not even a breath of what's needed to do that kind of detailed repair. So I reckon I don't know what they're doing with micros, whether they can say, well, it's just a it's just a MOSFET that's going and we'll change that, or it's something simple, a resistor's blown, and anything more simple we say, no, it's not economical for us to fix. I don't know. It seems too good to be true to me.
Well, maybe I should put it to the test and find out. Frank, just go back to when you set up Retro Rewind. What was it that prompted you? Was it seeing other services and how they performed, or was it just a hobby that got out of hand?
Do you want my honest answer? Was saving my marriage, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, okay.
we go back to this whole addiction talk, and it was more of a, seriously, you're spending a lot of time and money on this. All kidding aside, it's kind of hard to quantify exactly how it started, but it was, I'd scratch my own itch. I'd design stuff, our 64 power supply as an example, or our diagnostic kits, and had spares laying around. People wanted them in various forums. I was on Discord servers, and that kind of just snowballed into this chaos, this rocket that I've been trying to hold on to as tightly as possible for the past couple of years. I had to learn the business aspect of it, which frankly is not my thing, to be perfectly honest. No pun intended. Thankfully my wife helps with that. She kind of does the administrative work, the financial administrative work, because otherwise we'd be bankrupt, to be perfectly honest with you. But it was more to scratch my own itch, and now I'm scratching other people's itches, as weird as that sounds, for money.
But there you go. You heard it here first. Use Retro Rewind for the sake of Frank's marriage. That's the hook.
I'm always a little bit skeptical about repairs and so on in retro, just because of, I think, people's expectations about what it should cost. And really, when you start adding up, hang on, if you have someone spend 3 hours on this, you need to pay them a lot of money for it.
Yeah, I mean, we've had some backlash from people that, you know, think that, you know, they should only spend $50 to have an Amiga 4000 completely repaired from battery damage. And unfortunately, that's not the way it works, because I mean, we've got bills, we've got employees now, and all that other fun stuff that we have to take care of. And although I don't think we are outrageously expensive, I do understand the concern that some people have. And we have had machines that we've spent, or at least sat in the shop for a year, year and a half, because customers do want them fixed, but they don't. Like, they'll do a payment plan. We'll work out something with them to get it fixed. Like I said earlier, some of these custom chips, you know, like I just spent, it was $575 US on an Amber chip.
An Amber. Is that the scan doubler, the flicker fixer?
Correct. That is the flicker fixer chip. Yeah.
I know that I think there's people who are trying to get hold of old machines to restore them, refurbish them, and then sell them on for a profit. And I think they're kidding themselves on. I think you need to have a customer who has the machine rather than try and buy a machine and then sell a restored machine. I don't think there's that much money in the majority of those, unless it's something rare like a 4000.
Yeah, or like as an example, for the viewers / listeners who are Amiga fans, you might recognize this beauty, which is the Blizzard PPC for $1,200. These things, the repair on this thing cost, I think the final total bill is about $780 to repair this. But it's an incredibly rare piece. It's an incredibly expensive piece. It's the one that actually has the 060 and a power PC chip on board.
Yeah.
And, it is an investment in the long term, because
that's what we tell ourselves.
Outrageous. Yeah.
Invested. I'm invested.
That's right.
Invested.
But that customer, clearly, there are options out there. They didn't want to use a Pi-Storm. They didn't want to use a Terrible Fire. They wanted to use this original piece of period authentic kit, and they were happy to pay for it. Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, though, emulation's fine. So if you're not emulating, then there has to be a reason you're not emulating. And if the reason is because you want to have your own, the one you've had all your life, well, more power to you. I understand why. Going back to CX, though, I'm fascinated to find out how this will work. It seems too good to be true. I don't know how they'll manage it. I mean, there's modern consoles, your modern Xbox, your modern PlayStation is a PC. It's a PC in terms of the parts there, and sort of almost a hybrid laptop form. So fixing that for £40, not sure how they'll do it, but good luck to them anyway.
Well, if anything, I think this chat has convinced me I should put CEX to the test in the name of market research. So I will do that. But for anyone else, I can thoroughly recommend retrorewind.ca. Frank, what geographical area do you cover?
The entire world, save and except
entire world.
Countries that might be under government sanctions, which we're not allowed to deal with. Apart from that, we cover we had 3,000 in from Japan maybe 3 weeks ago. So I think that's the farthest that I can think of that we've repaired machines. But that really is the other side of the world.
Yeah. There you go. Check out retrorewind.ca, and I will check out CEX, and I will report back.
Welcome to Dave's Housekeeping. Such a great part of the show. Welcome to Dave's Housekeeping. A part of This Week in Retro, which is a podcast about retro computers and retro games. 8-bit and 16-bit stuff. Dave's Housekeeping. Dave's Housekeeping.
I want to welcome on two new patrons this week, Ben and Crowbotto. Thank you very much for signing up to be twirlers.
No, it's Orobotto. There's no C. Ben and Orobotto.
Orobotto, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry, I've added a C there.
Yeah.
That's my old tired eyes. Thank you very much for signing up, and apologies for getting your name wrong. If you want to become a patron, Neil, how would you do it?
You would go to patreon.com/thisweekinretro, where you can get the prestigious title of Twirler if you support us, and a pink name on the Discord server. What more could you want?
Magenta. It's a lovely colour of magenta. We're going to record our Q&A soon, patron Q&A soon. And there's been an update on the Nintendo stuff that we keep touching on. Discord has shut down the Discord servers for Nintendo Switch emulators, SUYU, which is the sequel to the one that was replacing the one that was shut down, that was closed down intentionally, and Sudachi, and has completely disabled their lead developers' accounts. And the company isn't answering questions about why it went that far. Now, that feels to me very heavy-handed, and I'm not comfortable with it at all. I suppose we do need to remember that these are apparently piracy hubs, but even still, I don't like the idea of Discord just shutting things down and not telling you why. Briefs, Neil. Shall I get my briefs out?
Briefs. Get your briefs out, Dave.
The Trocadero is to be turned back into an arcade, a truly top-notch one, according to London Mayor candidate.
I know which one, though. Come on.
Yes, I know.
You can't take this seriously.
This is on a list of other things like the reintroduction of CFAX. It's from Count Binface. Count Binface. And as I understand, he might not win. It's a chance. I know we avoid politics mostly here, but he's not far wrong in most stuff. And the Trocadero, which I don't know what it is, other than hearing it continually mentioned in retro circles, would be well restored to an arcade, I'm sure. So thanks, Specific Low 9474, for submitting that one.
I want to ask Frank, does this happen in Canada? So we have spoof candidates who run in an official capacity that, you know, they could win. But we have like Count Binface. We had a dolphin once, a man dressed as a dolphin. The Monster Raven Loony Party and Screaming Lord Such. Lots of those things. Does that happen over there?
Yeah, I mean, you might not remember this, but I'd say about 7 or 8 years ago, we had a crack-smoking mayor. So,
I remember him. Yeah,
Rob Ford. Yeah. So,
he wasn't intended to be a joke, though.
So kind of common practice. Seeing people dressed up in dolphin costumes, they got my vote at that point.
In other news in brief, the Amstrad CPC 464 has hit 40 years old. It was my first computer. It was nearly Dave's first computer. He had the 6128. And this story was submitted by Fig101, Dr. Local, and Affectionate. Affectionate? Yeah.
Affectionate Fig101.
Oh, okay.
And Dr. Local.
Sorry, that's one name, Affectionate Fig. So happy birthday to the Amstrad CPC. It's odd because I was so young when I got it, but I remember it like it was yesterday. It's such a vivid memory, that first computer and first turning it on and everything that came to life on that screen. Yeah, powerful memories. What was your first, Frank? You did tell us earlier, didn't you? It was the Cocoa 2.
Cocoa 2.
Was it a Christmas present? Was it a birthday present?
It was a birthday present. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have vivid memories of that day? Do you remember?
I have more vivid memories of picking up the 64 when we sold it, to be perfectly honest with you. But
Cocoa in the mud.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's just, it was the, I mean, there was no internet. There were BBSs back then, but 300 baud tops. So you were influenced by your circle of friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. It's a shared experience. I get that. All is not well in the world of FPGA retro gaming, according to Time Extension. So this is about the supposed fallout and problems with the Mars program. When the Mars program is, well, if you think of Mister, it's Mister with bells on. It's much more powerful. And while I have pretty much exactly zero intention of buying into Mars, it's not really what I'm interested in. I think it's a bit Homer Simpson card. I think there's too much in it. I think it's too expensive for what it is or what people want. I wish it all the luck in the world. A rising tide lifts all boats. And I think when they do get to market, and I'm pretty sure they will, in the next month or two, they'll have a very nice high-end alternative to Mister. And I think all the drama talk and so on is from people who want there to be drama. I don't think there's as much drama as people say there is. So good luck to them. Thank you to Rich2600 for submitting that.
Yeah, bang on. People who want drama for drama's sake.
Yeah.
Matt CK has backported .NET to Windows 95, which makes loads of things work that you wouldn't expect to. Mark Central, thank you, Mark, for submitting that. This is our resident flight sim expert, Mark Central. A nice detailed video that goes into absolutely loads of Windows 95 era clips that you may have forgotten, but you will remember when you see them. Yes, it was... Jennifer Aniston and
Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc doing the how to use Windows. There's a reason I forgot that. Anyway, the link is on the subreddit.
Ori Gunner links a YouTube documentary on the story of the Oregon Trail. This is a very fondly remembered educational game, but it's a fun game. It's an enjoyable game you can play rather than a one that's just lecturing at you. He says he's not sure if it made it over to Europe, and I'm not certain that it did in its time. It certainly did shortly afterwards. I feel that it probably did. It was too big over there not to make it over here, but it certainly made its way afterwards. I'll be watching that later. You have died of dysentery.
You can't do an Oregon Trail story without saying that.
You have to say it, don't you?
Yeah. Tested a Murder submits a BBC clip about Paul Daniels. You'll like it.
Not a lot.
The famous magician over here. And it turns out he was a huge Micro fan. I think that's quite common knowledge. And I think I've seen this clip before, or I've seen a very similar clip that was probably recorded at the same time. This particular one is about him stopping burglars using his Atari 800. So he's talking about home automation. But there are other clips where he's talking about a game that he's developed. So, Paul Daniels, a big Atari 800 fan back in the day.
And it's another clip from the same source as the story we covered earlier, a 1983 BBC news clip on it.
Right.
So very interesting. A new 50 frames per second racer on the ST is coming. So thank you to SoggyFennel448 for this. The creator of Atari ST's pole position and behind porting Lotus, that's Jonathan Thomas, is working on his own game. And it does look tremendous. The footage is running at a smooth 50 frames per second on a base 8 megahertz STE. And that's a real achievement. And if you compare that to what we got in the late 80s, like Outrun, etc., it absolutely blows it away. I've been watching development for a while. On Twitter, he fairly frequently will put an update on. You can see how it looks. It looks great. Eventually, in the 90s, we got stuff like No Second Prize and Formula One GP and Vroom, which were great racing games on the ST, but they're more simulation. There's never been really a fantastic arcade racer on the ST that's absolutely brilliant. It's always been, that'll do. So have a look at that in the subreddit if you want to.
You had the Lotus games on the ST; they're pretty good.
Yeah, but they're not brilliant. In fact, in the cave, you and I were comparing the ST version of the Amiga, and they've done very well with the ST one. It's just not great.
It's just not great compared to what, Dave?
Compared to the arcades. The arcades.
You won't say the Amiga's better. Frank, favorite racing game of all time?
Of all time?
Of all time.
Daytona.
Oh, nice. Hmm. Nice. Dave?
Stunt Car Racer.
Oh, good choice. Yeah, I'll go with Outrun. Yeah. There is Trouble in Mill of Amiga. Hyperion have gone into management by Liquidator. This was submitted by listener Fiskit. It's unclear as to what's going on exactly, and if it's the end of Hyperion or if it will just be rebranded and relaunched or what's going on. And there's a clarification that the word should be receiver, not liquidator, by someone else. So that's slightly less severe, apparently. I don't know the ins and outs, but Frank's nodding there. So Frank, maybe this is your chance. You're in. Come on, grab those Amiga rights. You could be Mr. Amiga.
Well, we are we're a licensed partner with Hyperion, so we're kind of somewhat privy to what is going on there, and it is. I think it's restructuring might be the best way to.
Yeah, the impression I got is that it's not Hyperion themselves; it's the people that own it, and I think it's probably going to end up being business as usual once all the background stuff has gone on. But I'm not sure, and we'll see.
Everyone likes a bit of drama, though, Dave.
I know. Drama where there's maybe not as much drama as there is. Yeah. Loads more on the subreddit. Absolutely tons to read there. The subreddit address, Neil?
reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro.
You can go there. You can participate in there. You can chat on the different submissions. You can upvote and downvote things. You want to talk about them and submit new stories yourself. Go and have fun. When I say the word abandonware, some of you, in fact, most of you, will know exactly what I mean and what it means in terms of playing games. Abandonware used to simply just mean games that had passed out of their commercial cycle and no one seemed to care about. It's absolutely not a legal definition, and it was never recognised anywhere as entitlement to pirate those games, but in effect, that's what happened. The cycle used to be that a game was released with as much fanfare as they could manage, and it was sold at full price. And for a very small number of games, they even had these premium funny-shaped boxes, like Neil was talking about the other week on his channel with Prince of Persia, for example, and Dune. Then it might be discounted or re-released, and here's an example, you're the seventh guest in a white-label box. In the UK, we loved repackaging them in pricing that shouted about how much a bargain it was, which made it feel a bit cheap. And I think in the US, they weren't quite as trashy as us. They had a bit more taste. They did their own ways, but having collected big box games for a while, some of the UK stuff is a bit cheesy, and I reckon it made the experience a bit worse. And then afterwards, maybe what happened after the cut price release was done, we'd get the game in a compilation, maybe a compilation of similar games or games in a series or games from that publisher. The example I've got here is six full Space Quest games in one package. And then after that, no one cared. You might get it in a DVD case for absolute buttons, but that was it. The game stopped being sold. You might find it in a bargain bin, sometimes priced at nearly nothing to get rid of it. And you might be able to buy it secondhand, but that was it. And that's where abandonware came in. And we'll talk about my favourite site back at the height of it, and probably the most famous, Home of the Underdogs. It was made by Sarani Ashavarantakal. So apologies if I've got that wrong. Her copy of Sword of the Samurai, which I think 1989 game, had fallen apart. And she found it eventually on an abandonware web ring. Remember web rings, which inspired her to create the labor of love, which was Home of the Underdogs. And it wasn't just random downloads thrown together in zip files, all messy. It was reviews, and good reviews as well, with manual scans. And in my opinion, it was absolutely preservation of art that was just falling away and disappearing. Eventually, Home of the Underdogs faded away. I think that was down to it becoming less important because of the rise of Steam, and it made it cheap and easy for publishers to sell their own stuff again without having to make a box, media, and find shelf space.
Yeah, I would put Home of the Underdogs down as being one of those websites that really inspired me and my passion for retro. You know, I was there, I was reading it, I was enjoying the website. But you do know, Dave, it's still online, homeoftheunderdogs.net.
Well, it's not. No? The site came up in 1998, and then 2009 it shut down, and someone's brought it back using an archive copy, but it's kind of like a...
Right.
It's not really the original. It's not run by the same lady.
And what I did notice is it has lists of games. You can read the reviews, you can see the box art and everything, but the download link is gone. Instead, there's a link that just takes you to Google search with the name of the game in the search box.
Right.
So you're not downloading any of that.
Yeah, it's always been a bit of a minefield. And there was, for people who aren't aware, there was a long period of time where there just wasn't a way to buy an old game. And if I look back at my old Steam library, the first purchase I made in that was XCOM UFO Unknown. That's an early 90s MicroProse game, which had just vanished. But I loved playing it all that way through. So I went on there and bought it on Steam. That was a great way of doing it. But Abandonware, that's Abandonware as I knew it. But there's a new kind of Abandonware, and it's pretty incredible how history is repeating itself here. So today's submission is a video and an appeal and a campaign from YouTuber Accursed Farms. Now, Ross starts out by talking about a game called The Crew, and it's a Ubisoft game which came out to mixed reviews. It's not a massive success. It's clearly not a commercial failure, though, as within 3 years of its 2014 launch, it had 12 million players. So that's a lot of players. But in December last year, Ubisoft delisted the games and expansions from digital platforms, suspended sales of microtransactions, and said the game would be shut down on the 31st of March 2024. A few days after the shutdown, so that's earlier this month, they began revoking licenses for people who had bought it. So if you paid for the game, they cancelled it. That's it. You're not playing it. They've said the game's run its course. That's been, I don't know, 10 years or less than 10 years slightly. You can't play it anymore. We're taking it away from you. Now, Ross isn't doing this because he's a giant big fan of The Crew. He's doing it because it's not the only example. It's happening right across the industry. Now, Tech Tangent channel Shelby, who's a previous guest on here, spent some time looking at his purchased DVD games to find out what the state of them was. So he's looking at things like Fable 3 and so on. Now, the game is there on the disc, minus, of course, later patches, but the game's complete on the disc. You can play it, or you should be able to play it. But for a large number of these games, they're simply dead. You can't install them. The online services that they need to verify against are shut down. Now, for some, you can go through hoops and get them working, maybe register it on Steam, or the publisher will release a patch, but not all of them. And for most of them, you have to go through and get a patch.exe, which is a third-party crack, and you're risking downloading something dodgy there, and you shouldn't need to do that. So what Ross and Shelby, and in fact me too, what we want for games to be owned and not expire, and for them not to be able to take them back from you, and that's why he started this campaign site called Stop Killing Games. And I think if you're into retro at all, you must see him how important this is. Now, I'm going to get a Blade Runner quote in here. I'm super proud of myself for getting a Blade Runner quote on the show. All these moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. And they shouldn't be, and that shouldn't be the way it is. So Rossi's goal is to force legislative bodies, that's governments in other words, to look at this and issue some kind of legislation. And if you're thinking, oh, this will never work out, it's pie in the sky, I don't agree. Because all it needs, and Ross recognises, is one country or jurisdiction to tell publishers you can't do this. And if the publisher has to do it for that jurisdiction, they'll likely just do it across the world. All we're wanting is for publishers making a single-player game to not kill the game off when they decide to stop commercially exploiting it. Now, it's a subject I'm angry and passionate about, and I'm not going to take it anymore, Neil. What are your thoughts on this? Do you care?
I care. I'd like to hear Frank's thoughts, to be honest, first of all. Okay. Where do you sit with this, Frank?
So I'm a big believer in... two things, right to repair and right to own stuff that you buy. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation here in North America, has been working on a public campaign around this exact thing. Many years ago, at least here in Canada, I'm not sure about the States, but many years ago here, does anybody remember the little dongles, security dongles, whether it be with AutoCAD or even Delphi on the C64, the database system
had Cubase, things like that.
Yeah. AST, yep.
Those were legislated, that whole industry was legislated here in Canada specifically because, you know, I own this software. Let's say I wanted to sell it to Dave or Neil, didn't have the dongle, that became an issue. I have the ability to use that software on multiple machines. How come I don't have multiple security devices? So here in Canada, we have some pretty good consumer protection legislation around stuff like that. You know, it's kind of still vague around online marketplaces, you know, like the Wii store, for example. There was some kerfuffle when they shut down here.
Great word.
Kerfuffle.
Yeah. Listen, I'm a big believer that you own it, it's yours, right? Mm. I just had this discussion with my son the other day, whose PS5 library contains like zero physical media, none whatsoever. And the question is, well, what happens if, you know, they decide to shut it down or God forbid, you know, somebody, you know, it's Sony. No one's ever hacked them before. Their online store's never been down for weeks at a time. That's never happened. But I think today's generation, that's what they're used to. Where we got, you know, we got physical discs, right? When we bought our games. And you don't see that as much anymore, which is a shame. It really is a shame.
I opened a copy of the original King's Quest recently on the IBM Junior PC Junior, and it had the disc, and it also had a little certificate with it that said this certificate entitles the holder to make a backup copy of this physical floppy disk. So you could have your backup and a certificate so you don't go to jail. I like that.
Yeah, I Ross does talk about some of the things you've said in there. I've noticed myself that sometimes when you buy a new game, it comes with free add-on DLC, which is only for you. So if you were then to sell the game on, somehow they wouldn't get the DLC. There's lots of problems there. But one of the things, Ross, an important thing he raises is that these things are undefined. He tried to get answers from Germany and France on what their rules were, and the answers are undefined. This hasn't gone to Parliament. It's not been tested. The rules are vague or they're there already, whether they would apply to this or not, and it's time for the rules to be written on it. So that's part of the reason for the campaign to be done.
And surely it has knock-on effects to a lot of other areas. For example, some of the systems in my car that require a subscription and use online services, they're gone, what happens to that? Are they just disabled in the car? Are there workarounds? I don't know.
I think with those, if you start out by buying a subscription for it, then you've got less cause for complaint. But Rossi's point with the crew was you bought the crew. You didn't buy a license to play the crew. You bought the crew. That was you buying the game, and they've taken that from you. Mm. You haven't paid for a service to play the crew for a certain length of time, or if you have, it was so deep in the terms of service that it should be struck out.
And just to clarify, mm-hmm. Dave, this is specifically, we're talking about single player games, are we? Because once you go into the realms of MMOs and the kind of servers and that they need, you're asking for quite a lot. In the name of preservation from these companies, yeah.
The goal is not to force companies to keep servers on perpetually. That would be ridiculous. Mm. It goes too far. But it would mean that single-player games, which there's almost no proper single-player games now. They all have an online element to them. And that online element mustn't be used to force the game to shut down. I don't think it would be applied to an online game like League of Legends, for example, is an online game. If they shut down their servers, then you can't play it because you would need it. They need the servers there for it. But a modern game that has some kind of online element shouldn't be killed off because the online element's gone. And they also have to have some kind of fallback position for what happens when it falls down. How do you get access to these things that may be vital for gameplay in it?
But Cisco's been doing this for decades, right? It's the same policy. I mean, you spend $50,000 on a high-end piece of networking equipment, but you don't have the right to use it until you pay them a yearly licensing fee with it. I mean, a coworker of mine equated it once to, you bought a car, but you got a license to use the steering wheel every month. And if you don't pay that monthly license, we take the steering wheel away, and that $50,000 automobile you just bought is no good anymore.
Yeah. It's different. So, it's different if it's my car has a tracker and it has updating maps, and if I don't pay to update those, they don't get updated. But I can still get in the car.
But your car still works,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. If it's the basic function of it, that seems wrong to me.
And also, you know, when you're thinking about MMOs, it's just code. It's just code. If you've got a policy that says when a game is retired from the mainstream, you must release the server-side code, that would be great, wouldn't it? Just so we can stand up. We're not expecting millions of people to go back to that game 20 years later. But if 10 of us can go in there just to say, okay, let's look at this little bit of history of video gaming, then that's great. I'd stand up a server to do that if I've got the server-side code. I'm on board with this, Dave. I'm on board with this. How do I support this?
So what I'm asking our audience to do is to go to Stop Killing Games, link in the show notes, and do what he asks. And in most cases, depending on where you live, that's just filling in a petition for your government to look at it. Please do it. This does matter. It will have an effect on games going forward that will be retro in 20 or 30 years' time. It's important this happens for the sake of preservation.
Time now for our community question of the week. So last week's question was based around the story where it was decided in a poll by BAFTA, or at BAFTA, that Lara Croft was the most iconic video game character of all time.
It's very good rage bait, isn't it?
Not Sonic, not Donkey Kong, none of that. It was Lara Croft, apparently. So we put the same question to you. Who are your three most iconic characters in video game history? No more or less than three. Has to be three. No excuses, no working around the rules. We're going to be really strict with this, aren't we, Dave?
Yeah, we are. Should we ask Frank first? Do you want some time, Frank, or do you think you can answer?
Oh no, I can totally answer. Donkey Kong, Mario, and Ryu from Street Fighter.
Nice.
There we go.
Reasonable. Solid answers. Dave, have you taken us out of contest mode?
No.
Drum roll.
No, I don't see how to do it. I'm logged in and it won't let me do it.
Oh yeah, it's disappeared.
Yeah. What's it doing?
Oh, I have got a new button which says adjust crowd control. What's that all about?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, what an absolute shambles. We can get beyond it. So we can get beyond it. We can read out the answers here.
We can read out the answers, yeah. First for the show. This is exciting. Yeah. Okay. So our top answer is from Prefim, who says Miner Willy from the Manic Miner Jet Set Willy trilogy. Jetman from the Jetpack Lunar Jetman games, and Rex from 3D Monster Maze on the ZX81, a character so scary it could literally kill your computer if you got scared and bumped the RAM back. That's a good one. Yes, I don't know how many kids today would recognize Rex from 3D Monster Maze.
Tested a merda. You put out strict rules last week, Neil, and I understand why you did. And that's caused people to try and break the rules.
Yes, I see.
In creative ways. So I applaud what Tester the Murder said. Number one, Black Spy. Number two, White Spy. And number three, Versus. This is Spy versus Spy.
It is. Did you have a favorite from the series? I like the Island Caper. I like that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Great game.
Was that not based in Mad Magazine?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Dick DiBartolo. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great game. Happy Coding ZX has the third answer. I decided to come at this from a different angle. Don't be breaking the rules now. He asked myself, which video game character would you recognize as an actual desktop icon to represent video games as a whole? Ones that every generation would recognize representing gaming. I mean, you're still picking something that's iconic.
Yeah.
So it's still the same sort of thing. So he said a mid-jump Mario / Jumpman from Donkey Kong / Super Mario Brothers. So Mario, but specifically jumping.
Yeah, that does look most Mario of anything, yeah.
An open-mouth Pac-Man.
Of course.
It would have to be open-mouth, otherwise you've just got a circle. So that makes sense.
Or a ball.
That's Ms. Pac-Man, yeah. And number one, the classic Space Invader from Space Invaders, because it has become a symbol of our entire hobby. I think that's a really good answer, the Space Invader sprite. Yeah. Very recognizable.
Yeah. Just like disk has become an icon for save, even though there's a whole generation using that save icon who's never touched a disk.
Mm. Lots of other answers. So thank you to everyone who participated. We had Pitfall Harry, Rick Dangerous, James Pond. We had Mario Sonic, Beardy Wizard Dude from the cover of Chess Master. And I know exactly who you're talking about. Robotron, the athlete in Hyper Olympics, Heimdall, Guybrush, Threepwood. Guybrush Threepwood has to be in there. Batman, I would say a movie icon or a comic book icon before.
I know. Yeah. I think we want to stay away from things comic that came into gaming. I thought there was one particularly good one from Computerist 1969. His number three is the Avatar from Ultima.
Oh, because yeah, it's right.
Me, and I recognize me fairly easily.
Bub and Bob, Dylan from Dizzy, Monty Moe. So many other Super Frog. I wouldn't put Super Frog up there. Leisure Suit Larry.
Christopher Blair, Wing Commander.
Bernard, if I say these three names, Bernard, Laverne, and Hoagie, do you know what game I'm talking about?
Yeah. Day the Tentacle and Manny Mansion, yeah.
Yeah. Maniac Mansion, Dave.
Sorry. Manic Miner.
Bomberman, Donkey Kong, Gallagher. Yeah, so many great answers in that. Loads of answers, actually. I'm still scrolling. So thank you to everyone who participated. This week, our question of the week is around fixing things. So our question is quite simply, what do you wish that you'd fixed, but you threw away? So maybe you didn't have the skills to fix it. Maybe you couldn't afford to fix it. Or it was just taking up space and you thought, I'll never get round to that. So you threw it away. What do you wish that you'd fixed, but you threw it away?
My personality.
Oh, see, Frank.
Minus 10 points for the first person to say my marriage.
So that's the question. You can head to reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. You can go to patreon.com/thisweekinretro if you really want to support the show. You can go to rmcretro.store if you want to buy the official mug of the show. And have I missed anything? Retrorewind.ca. Yeah.
Going to see
if you've still got that thing you wished you'd fixed and you haven't thrown it away, throw it Frank's way and he'll get that fixed for you. And I think that's all the links. So thank you.
Make sure you put it in a box and wrap it really well before you throw it out.
Put it in a box. Yeah.
And maybe speak to him first.
And there's a process online they can fill out.
There you go. So thank you again, Frank, for joining us. Dave, have a good week. Frank, have a good week. And all of you, have a wonderful week. Thank you so much. Or wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye. They're waving.
Bye.
That's a 7 a.m. wave, if ever I saw one from Frank there.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RMC The Cave and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. Podcast version of the show is available through your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.